Coming up next on the Jordan Harbinger Show.
So the chapter president at the time was like, hey, listen, I got permission for you to get Sutar's sword early. They'd broken a bunch of things with me early. Like, I became an officer earlier than I was supposed to. I got arrested, and so I should have been pushed out of the club until that case got adjudicated. Like, there's all these different things that they had, rules they broke it for me. So when it came to this, I'm like, hey, man, I go home with Sutar's sword in my neck. This is not going to play well with my wife to start with, and then forget where else. And so I said to him, I said, hey, listen, man, I'm already getting some attitude for some folks because, you know, I've been cutting corners and you guys have been doing things for me earlier than, you know, probably should have. Let's just let this one run out. Let me do my time and earn this one. The chapter president was like, hey, man, that's stand up 100% behind you. So it was another bullet dodged.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. On the Jordan Harbinger Show, we decode the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's most fascinating people. We have in-depth conversations with scientists and entrepreneurs, spies and psychologists, even the occasional organized crime figure, former cult member, or rocket scientist, and each episode turns our guests' wisdom into practical advice that you can use to build a deeper understanding of how the world works and become a better thinker. If you're new to the show or you want to tell your friends about it, our starter packs are where you do it. These are collections of our favorite episodes organized by topic to help new listeners get a taste of everything we do here on the show. Topics like persuasion and influence, disinformation and cyber warfare, scams and conspiracy debunks, crime and cults, China and North Korea, and more. Just visit jordanharbinger.com/start or search for us in your Spotify app to get started. Today's guest, man, folks, where do I begin? Okay, he spent years undercover with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the ATF. Now, usually these guys specialize in catching bad guys moving guns, bombs, other super dangerous and illicit material. If you're not from the United States or you have no idea what I'm talking about, it's kind of like the FBI, but focusing on alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. And most undercover operations, they are a few weeks, maybe a few months. This operation lasted years, which is just unreal. He infiltrated the Pagans Motorcycle Club. So think Hell's Angels or Mongols or Sons of Anarchy, if you've seen that show. Just a crazy dangerous group of guys that would be scary to even be around, let alone go into the lion's den for years at a time and try to dismantle the organization from the inside. The stories in this episode are absolutely bananas, and we are just lucky as a society to have guys like Ken Croak keeping us safe from some of the absolute animals out there who just don't give a crap about anything or anyone. This is a two-parter. There's a lot here. Let's do it. You know, when you're undercover, you must see these guys' IDs sometimes, or no? Or is that kind of not a thing that happens?
It depends on, you know, the type of undercover. Like, if it's short-term or regular undercover, you know exactly who it is you're meeting with. You know what their background is, what they're capable of, and you'll know their names, but it's short term. When you're doing this long term, particularly when you're meeting hundreds of people over a period of time, the odds of you, because some of them go by their real names, some of them go by their club names. And so, whatever, it's just like I'm introduced to Jordan. You know, if I knew your nickname was Bill and somewhere I refer to you as Bill, and you'd be like, where'd you get that from?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. Yeah.
I always told them, just don't tell me. As long as you know who they are. Now, you could tell me, hey, how bad are they? Like, if they killed five people, so I know, you know, I have that going in. But outside of that, don't give me much more.
Yeah, because you don't want to say like a gang name that only a gang member would know. And if they haven't introduced you is that way and they've given you something totally different, it just totally blows you up, right? Because it's like, well, who do you know that knows me that told you my name, right?
Or these guys use aliases all the time. They'll throw them out there. And if all of a sudden they threw an alias out 5 years ago and I happen to use that alias, as opposed, they'd be like, only a cop would know that.
Uh-huh.
I just try to keep it as simple as I can. And like I said, this type of investigation, you know, people are always like, oh yeah, it's amazing. It's this. The hardest part of this was keeping your story straight.
I bet.
For 2 years. You know, people have always asked me like, how do you do it? And I'm like, well, you know, how difficult is it? And I use the same analogy, which is, so tell me a lie about last night, where you went to dinner, who you went with, what was the restaurant, what did you eat, what was the environment, who was sitting around you, and get into some details. And you'll sling that out in a second, and it'll sound very convincing, and I'll believe you. But then I'm going to circle back next week, and I'm going to come back, and I'm going to say to you, hey, how did you have your steak cooked last week? And you have told me, and if it was a real memory, you'd remember it. If it's not, then it's very hard to recall because you just made that stuff up. And so then do that over 2 years and it gets to be really difficult. And these guys would regularly, particularly Roadblock, would regularly circle back on my stories to see how valid they were.
Roadblock is one of the guys in the club. Was that the guy that sort of sponsored you to see if you were... It's hard to keep these names straight for me, having read the book. There was one guy who kept testing you. I assume that's who that was, yeah?
Yeah, him and Peter, probably the two biggest when it came to testing. But Roadblock was my sponsor. At the time, he was a sergeant at arms. The chapter president wanted me into the club. Mm-hmm. But presidents generally are not supposed to sponsor folks. So he designated Roadblock to be my sponsor.
Yeah, so that seems to be one of the reasons why you hear undercovers say, like, always use as many real details as you can so that you don't have, you can always default to like, hey, I get my steaks done medium. Maybe I'm a vegan, you know, or a vegetarian. You don't have to pretend you're not or that you are for something else. And maybe you use like what, like a real first name, but a fake last name. Is that kind of the general gist?
Most folks will use their real first name because again, if I'm going to an alley and meeting you and buying a gun, and it's going to be a half hour, whatever, you know, you could stay focused for that. But over a 2 year period, if all of a sudden I changed my name to Harry, inevitably, somebody would have been like, hey, Harry, and I wouldn't have turned around. It just wouldn't click. Whereas if you keep the same first name, you know, you'll naturally respond.
Yeah, that's, oh man, the pressure is just ridiculous. Let me back up a little bit. How did you end up deciding to / getting selected to work undercover? I assume they don't make you do that. They ask you if you want to, right?
Yeah, you're talking all the way back at like day one of my career.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they do not make you do it. When you're in the academy, at least when I went to the academy, everyone was, you had to do it in that environment. So you could at least, for two reasons. One, see if you liked it. Number two, you have to have an appreciation of what it's like to be an undercover. And again, it's an academy environment. Nobody's going to die, but it is, they do make it as real as they possibly can. And even if you never did it again, you'll understand what undercovers go through. And when you are planning your operations and you're asking someone to do undercover for you, you'll have a little bit more understanding of how that process works and what they're going through when they're doing that. But then afterwards, it's just for me in the academy, and you know, I thought I did pretty good at it. And I also felt like a lot of the undercover work was kind of pushed on to different minority groups. And so it'd be like, hey, you look the part type of thing. And I always felt like, you know, looking the part, you got to be able to explain what you look like. And so, you know, I did undercover with African-American gangs, Hispanic gangs. It's all your story and who's introducing you in. So I did, you know, a fair amount of undercover with MS, Mara Substitute, the street gang. And everyone's like, how's a white guy, you know, do that?
Yeah. Isn't that El Salvador-based gang? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is when I was in Los Angeles and they were big in Los Angeles. But my story was there was a prostitute who worked down in that area who's white. She introduced me into the gang. So I was her brother. So then they accepted that, like, all right, yeah, we got this white guy here. He's, you know, buying some guns and some drugs and what have you. So it's really your story more so than it is what you look like. And so I wanted to kind of change that. And then further I went along with it or got into it, the more I enjoyed doing it. You know, I looked at it as a challenge. It's almost like a chess match. Mm. I was not one-dimensional in my career and I never intended to. You know, I worked really good cases. I had gone up into management, up to the highest levels within the agency. So it was, I just wanted to be a well-rounded agent.
Yeah. It sounds like the level of excitement for undercover is much higher than, I'm stereotyping here, but it seems like if you join in the police or the ATF in your case to be close to the action, there's no closer to the action than pretending to be in a gang and selling drugs with a gang and running guns with a gang for whether it's half an hour or half a year.
Some would view it that way. And I think it's, but there's also, you know, if you're on the SRT team, you know, there's a lot of adrenaline.
That's like a SWAT team situation. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so you know, there's a lot of aspects of the job that get that adrenaline, you know, flowing. But this to me was one where it's kind of like a skill set and you develop it as you go along and you get a little bit better. You have to be very quick in thinking because even the short-term stuff, all of a sudden something comes up and somebody throws something at you, you've got to be able to respond to it just like you naturally would. And this case was full of things that happened that I would get out of bed every day and, you know, I'd have a plan on what I was going to do. Mm. By 9 o'clock in the morning, that plan completely was blown up. And not a single day went according to what I thought it was going to do.
Yeah, it sounded like that from the book, too. You know, like, this is a full-time job and we'll kind of get to this because I took a copious amount of notes. But tell me a little bit about how biker gangs work. There's different club ranks, right? There's like the full-on patched members, and then there's these kind of, I guess, prospects who are, for lack of a better word, like applicants almost, right? Initiates.
More like indentured slaves.
Yeah.
So the process starts with hangarounds. And so hangarounds actually, you know, if you're ever going to hang around a biker gang, that's the level you want to be at, because they get to go to the parties. They have no responsibility. Nobody cares what they do. They're also not involved in any of the inner workings of the club. They won't know any of the criminal activities. They won't know a lot of anything, any of the dynamics that are happening inside. But they go to the clubs, you know, they go to the parties, they'll support them and so forth. But for the biker gangs, that's an important part, because they're watching you and how you are just normally. And so they're wanting to see, you know, is this a stand-up type of person? Is this somebody we want to be part of this? Do they have what it takes to be a part of it? And then if you do, the next phase, they're going to ask you to prospect. And that is by far the worst phase. It's a little bit different for each club. For the Pagans, it's 6 months. And they can add days to it, depending on what happens. And during that period of time, with the Pagans, you're a prospect for the what they consider to be the entire Pagan nation. So you don't belong to a chapter. You don't belong to a person. You belong to the entire Pagan group. So on a normal day, you're beholden to the chapter that you're in. But when you go to these mandatories where there's, you know, 1,000 bikers there, you're beholden to every single one of them. And so it is like indentured servitude. So like my first mandatory, we were up at 4 o'clock in the morning after, you know, maybe going to sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning. You're running the grills, you're going around picking up trash. You have these bags of things that you have to carry with you. Things being like spark plugs, lights for the motorcycle, cigarettes, tampon, like you name it, you're carrying all this stuff. And there's a list, like figure you have to have a lighter, you know, all this stuff. And if you don't have one of these items and one of those members ask you for it, several things can happen. One, they'll bang check you, which is an open palm strike to your forehead. Two, they can whack you with an axe handle if it's significant enough. I mean, if you're missing a toothpick, you're probably not going to get an axe handle, but other violations you would. Or they add days to your prospecting. And so you have this little calendar booklet you carry with you, and you cross off days as you complete them. And so if you screw up, it'd be like, hey, add another week, which I'd rather get bang checked than add time to the prospecting phase. And so like they say it's 6 months, but it's not like 6 months you're watching the clock wind down and you're like, hey, I've got 4 more hours. It's not that way. 6 months is the general time, and they'll let you know in their own special way when you've made it and when you know, or if you haven't.
Right. So you're done when they say you're done, not when you're like, hey, guys, this is my last day. Right?
Yeah. Exactly. Nope. Then you're a patched member and you're, you know, on probation for a period of time. And then there's officers within the club. And so back to your original, there's a treasurer, secretary. There'll be a vice president who really doesn't have status unless the president's dead or in jail. Sergeant Arms, which is the number two in a chapter and also responsible for the weapons, but also the discipline. And then the chapter president. And then those chapters report up to what they call a president of presidents, a pop. And that's the level right below Mother Club. And then Mother Club has its own chapter. So the national president, the national vice president, the national sergeant arms are all across Mother Club. And so everybody reports up to that.
So Mother Club sounds like what? It's the national chapter instead of the local chapter of the Pagans?
Exactly. It's the national oversight. And so you'll have each Mother Club member will have an area. So, you know, I was in New York. So the Mother Club member at the time was Cano, and he had New York and Northern New Jersey. That was his area. So everybody reported up to him, and he was part of Mother Club.
Wow. It's like regional management, but it's also like a mafia with the commission and everything, right? Or the, is that what it's called? The commission?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. And there is a hierarchy. I mean, you know, people think that these are just a bunch of morons running around partying, and they're not. They're very sophisticated in how they move their money. They're very sophisticated in their structure. And they're also very sophisticated in what they do. They plan operationally. They have undercovers, the people who they call it, Ryan Slickback, no colors, no nothing, people who kind of look like they'd blend in. If they're going to events and stuff, they'll have those people out there planted, watching to see if rival gangs are showing, see what the local law enforcement are doing. They're planning, maybe not on paper like what law enforcement agencies do, but in the end, it's really the same thing. You know, they would brief and debrief after their, you know, events.
Wow. It's surprising because some of these guys are really horrific human beings. And I've got some examples that we can talk about in a little bit here. Early in the book, you talk about simulating using drugs and drinking at a party. And this is something I'd never thought about, right? Okay, you pour out a beer when no one's looking. Maybe you hold a shot in your mouth and then you kind of spit it back in your beer bottle when you're looks like you're chasing the booze so you don't get super drunk. But how do you fake a line of cocaine, right? That sounds like a challenge.
Yeah, so people ask that question. And honestly, I don't go into it. And I'll tell you why, because it just makes it more difficult for the people behind me, the folks that are going to be doing this type of work.
Yeah.
But I will say this, and it's easier to talk about the alcohol in that sense, is that, you know, there'd be plenty of nights that folks would be like, oh my God, you know, we were out, slam, had 10 beers last night. Well, the reality is, like, you think about the last time you're in a bar with some buddies and, you know, they're ordering different beers. Where did you really see them drink the beer? Did you really watch that liquid cross across their lips? Now, if you're watching somebody drink a beer and you're paying attention to it, you're going to be able to tell whether they drank it or not. But who does that? If you're going to sit there and say, hey, watch me, and I'm going to fool you into thinking I drank 10 beers, but just stare at me the whole time, you're not going to be able to pull it off. But that's not how it works. And so you do, like when it comes to alcohol, hey, you take your beer to the bathroom, dump it out, most of it out. And then you go back and you order. You make sure you buy everyone around, you know, so people know, hey, you know, he's back up at the bar again, you know, doing that kind of thing. And again, it's just people assume. And there was a time in the book where I talk about where it was a test, and a test that I would have failed if I didn't have some dumb luck on my side. And I had plenty of dumb luck throughout this case.
You definitely had some good luck in this case, which is fortunate. It's probably why you're here to tell this story. I just, doing the fake lines of cocaine, it seemed like there were some close calls. And I guess I've done all this training and tolerance building just in case I need to go undercover and I didn't need to do it for no reason at all. could have just done fake cocaine. Could have just faked it the whole time.
But, you know, like to your point, like you could sit here and say, hey, I'm not, because there is a huge risk to faking, you know, using drugs or the alcohol, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And even if on the alcohol, you know, people are going to say, oh, he was drunk the whole time. So when you take the stand, they're going to be like, oh, you were drunk because you had 10 beers. So you're like, you're always going against that. But the reality is, take the flip side. So here's this guy who parachutes in from nowhere. All of a sudden he's hanging around with these guys. Oh, by the way, he doesn't do drugs or alcohol,
right,
but he's willing to be a biker. It's like, come on. You know, at some point they're going to be like, really? Mother Teresa now wants to be a biker? Like, how does that work?
Why not just do, this is probably a dumb question, but why not just do a real line of cocaine, right? It's probably not going to kill you right away. I don't know. It seems like the risk, but the guy, if he finds that you're not doing it in front of him, he could kill you right away.
Yeah. And listen, this rules against it. It also would put you under the influence when, you know, and these are all things like everything, everyone thinks like, oh, you're just hanging out and you're having a good time. Mm. There's nothing fun about this. Not 1 minute of it is fun because it is a constant chess match. You're constantly at risk, but you're also constantly building a case. And everything you do during that time is going to be scrutinized later on when it comes time for trial or motions or what have you. And so you constantly have to be on guard against that. And you have to get the evidence you can get as far as whether it be recordings, video, or audio, copious notes, and be able to, you know, attest to everything that happens during that time. And so if something does happen on a script, now listen, if somebody were to put a gun to an undercover's head and said, do this line, I'm going to blow your brains out, the undercover's going to do the line. Mm-hmm. But then they're going to come out and they're going to write a report about how they did this line. They're going to go to the hospital because, you know, I know this will come as a shock to you, but somebody may say it's coke and it's not coke. It could be something else.
Yeah, it's
else.
Meth or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's all sorts of bad things that, I mean, that alone would be a reason not to do it because you don't know what the hell they're actually giving you.
Yeah.
So having that documentation, anytime you had, like, you know, for me, anytime I, you know, was part of any illegal activity, you had to make sure you documented all that because it's coming back. Somebody's going to say, hey, he was there. You know, he saw this person get beaten or whatever it was, and you better have documented it.
Yeah, you can't be like, so, man, I was really high on meth, but they made me do it, Your Honor. They made me do it.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is what happened.
Yeah.
That doesn't really play well in court.
Right. I was seeing triple, but I'm pretty sure that was the guy that hit him.
One other addition to that.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all been drunk at some time in our lives, and that's generally the time you do the stupidest of things. And so if your real life is what it is, and then all of a sudden you do this undercover role and you let your guard down and you drink 12 beers, what's the odds that you're not going to say the wrong name or the wrong thing about yourself? It's super high. Just another reason. It's hard enough to do it when you're sober. Another mind trying to add that into it.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, you don't want to start crying about your ex-girlfriend from back in Michigan and then like, I thought you were from New Jersey, man. What? Yeah. And also then you can't really defend yourself because you can't see straight.
Yep, exactly.
You talk about the Devil's Disciples, which is like, I guess like a minor league support club or versus the Outlaws who are legit. So what is the difference here? And why would somebody be in one but not the other? Why be in one club if you're trying to hang out with the pagans all the time? It is like AAA baseball.
So, I mean, in some ways it is. And that's, you know, when I do some training with law enforcement, I talk about it that way. It's like, it's the minor leagues. But really, you know, I don't mean that to sound negative. What it really is that it's a proving ground to start, number one. Number two, the support clubs are not as regimented as the big five are. or the big six, depending on, you know, the day. But the bigger clubs, there's a lot more to that membership. There's a lot more expected from you. The smaller support clubs, it's like, yeah, they're on. If they're going to a mandatory in support of like the Pagans, you know, for example, yeah, you better have your stuff dialed in because bad things can happen to you there and as a support role. But generally, they're treated pretty good because they want numbers. And so when there is an issue, they're going to call that support club and bring them in. So for some people, that's about, they're willing to be a weekend warrior, if you will, but they don't really want that full-time commitment. A lot of them go in there and they stay exactly there, or their lives change and they decide, hey, this isn't for me or whatever it is. But a lot do come up to those ranks.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. You can keep your day job as a truck driver or lawyer or doctor, and then you can sort of almost like LARP badass biker dude, and hopefully you don't get shot during a Hell's Angels dust up.
Yeah, exactly.
You said Big Five or Big Six, that you're talking about the major biker gangs, right? So what, Hell's Angels, Pagans, Mongols, Outlaws, which other clubs are there?
It depends on, you know, the Warlocks, the Vagos, depends on kind of the time. Their numbers swell and shrink, but really the biggest and most violent would be those gangs.
Warlock, I've never even heard of them. I guess I have heard of Vato. That's a Latin gang.
So Vagos, people will consider them to be a West Coast gang.
Okay.
And part of my backstory was that I rode with the Vagos. I was not a Vago, but I rode with the Vagos. Now, I had done some undercover work against the Vagos when I was in LA. And it seemed like a safe bet to use that as kind of a back. And I had done a bunch of research and you know, we had some folks that we knew where their bars were. And I went out and it was a part of that. So I had my whole backstory intact. What I never expected was the Vagos to skip the entire country and open a friggin' chapter in New York in the middle of our case. But that's like, that was an example of really bad luck.
Yeah.
But going back to my point at the beginning where I said, you know, you got to be quick on your toes. Their initial inclination was to talk about me, knowing that I knew people, like, oh, hey, you know, in the time I was a prospect, you're like, you know, Ken. And so I had said to them when I caught wind of this, I was like, hey, listen, man, something shady about this. Like the Vagos skipped the whole country and decided to open up in New York. Something going on here. I said, let's not let them know, you know, who I am. And let me check through my people back in California. And they bought that hook, line, and sinker, thank God. And they never did tell them. And I would feed them a bunch of BS intel that I was getting out of California that made sense, but it wasn't true. They were like, hey, this is great.
You're listening to the Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Ken Croak. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored in part by the Commercial Break Podcast. Have you ever wondered why somebody would date a ghost or why some people get married to cats? Have you ever thought to yourself, I should learn to speak a Martian language? Or why do television preachers have such expensive jets? Of course you don't. That's because you have better things to do with your time. But the good people over at the Commercial Break have plenty of time to waste, and they are answering these important questions and a whole lot more. The Commercial Break is a comedy podcast where two longtime best friends, Brian and Chrissy, get together every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to discuss life, love, and the pursuit of absurdity, like sinister ministers, ridiculous MLM companies, alien light language, TV dating shows, monster hunters, terrible psychics, and a whole lot more. The Commercial Break uses an unlikely friendship as a backdrop to discuss the insane topics they find online and reflect on their 20 wild years as best buds. The Commercial Break is available wherever you find your podcasts or visit tcbpodcast.com. Find all the video and audio of the show. You can also go to the Commercial Break on YouTube and find the video version of the podcast, and all of the episodes are available on the YouTube channel. If you're wondering how I managed to book all these amazing folks for the show, these authors, thinkers, creators, undercover agents, every single week, it is because of my network, and I'm teaching you how to build your network for free over at jordanharbinger.com/course. This course is about improving your networking and connection skills and inspiring others to develop a personal and professional relationship with you. It'll make you a better networker, a better connector, and a better thinker. That's at jordanharbinger.com/course. And by the way, most of the guests you hear on the show subscribe and contribute to the course. So come join us. You'll be in smart company where you belong. Now, back to Ken Croak. Okay, so to clarify for people who are listening and maybe a little confused, so your cover story included you were riding with this other gang back on the West Coast that wasn't present on the East Coast. And when you were undercover with the Pagans on the East Coast, suddenly this gang, the real actual gang, wanted to come and start a chapter there. And you were like, shit, they're going to ask about me. Then the people are going to say, I've never heard of this guy. Then your cover's blown, or at least there's a hole in it. So you made up some spiel about how they shouldn't say anything because it looked shady that they were jumping into York. And thankfully, they just decided to keep it quiet because of that.
Yeah. And if they don't know that I have connections there, then we could check on them unknowingly.
Right.
It worked like a charm, but it was, you know, for a minute or two, I was like, oh man, I'm screwed.
Yeah.
You know,
like, oh my God.
There's no way this is going to stand up.
Pagans and these other clubs are these big five, big six. These are full-time jobs, right? So these are not things where you go, oh, that would be fun to do. You know, I can probably take Friday afternoons off now that I'm older and I'm established in my career. This is your life, right? This is how you generate revenue. It's how you support your family if you have one. This is your job, right? When you're in a gang like this.
So some of these, you know, a lot of them don't have jobs. Some of them do have jobs. And some of them have, like, there was one guy worked on Wall Street and he did a lot of the money laundering and set up the LLCs for the funding and stuff like that. He's not the guy you bring into a barroom brawl because he's about 5 feet tall and he looked like a bowling ball. But there were some that had legitimate jobs. The club priority is the club activity. And so you have to live by that. But I will say that if you had a legitimate job, they would work around that for the most part. They weren't looking to get people fired from their jobs and just say, hey, you have to be full-time, you know, paying to be here, you know, whatever. Now, if there's a mandatory, you better be there. But mandatories were planned out so you would know. And if, you know, one of your brothers needed you, then you better drop whatever you're doing and get there. So most weren't working in the corporate world, if you will. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you'd have a lot of mechanics and folks like that that were part of the gang.
That makes sense.
And a lot were unemployed.
Everything I've learned, like everyone else you've probably talked to about this, everything I know about bikers is, aside from your book, from the show Sons of Anarchy. I got to wonder, did these guys watch that and go, oh, that's not how it is? Or are they obsessed with this show? That wouldn't surprise me.
So they refer to it as the Sons of Malarkey.
Okay.
And, but I will say this, it was the ultimate in irony. So I'm a make-believe biker hanging out with real bikers, watching a show about make-believe bikers. Like, you can't make this stuff up. And they would just make fun of the show the whole time. Now, part of their... There was some HA Hells Angels consultants rumored to be on that show. So that just made the Pagans hate it even more. But yeah, these guys, and not so much with the Sons of Anarchy, these guys did their homework. When there was books written, they gave me two books right when I was part of the gang. They said, read these and look for information in there that can help us identify who undercover cops are.
Wow.
And they would watch all those shows on Discovery and things like that. Gangland and all that stuff, looking for tidbits. It's one of the reasons why when I wrote this book, I was in to your question at the beginning about, you know, hey, how do you fake a line? Like, I don't give up that stuff in the book because there's no purpose. It doesn't change the story, but it does make it, I don't want to make it more difficult on the person who comes behind.
No, I completely understand that. I've had all kinds of people on here before and they're like, hey, that was a little bit of tradecraft that while interesting to you, probably shouldn't be because it's going to be very interesting to Al-Qaeda or like Iranian Special Service, Secret Service. And I'm like, okay, you know, I'll cut it out. I'd feel pretty bad if somebody got in trouble at the expense of me entertaining somebody with an anecdote on this podcast, right?
Yeah.
Tell me what the one percenter thing is. Because I've heard of the patches. I've heard of the one percenter clubs. I've seen that in movies as well. Like, what's the deal? What is a one percenter?
So it all comes back from a study that was done by the military back in, I think it was either late 50s or early 60s. And it, you know, everyone was saying, hey, motorcycle enthusiasts, bikers are all bad. So they did this whole study and basically out of the study, it came back and said, hey, listen, 99% of them aren't. You know, 1% of these bikers might be problematic or gang members or what have you, but the rest aren't. So the point of the report was like, don't judge just because they're bikers. Well, then the bikers, the real bikers, the outlaw bikers were like, hey, this is great. We are the 1%. We're proud of being the 1%. There's only certain clubs that can wear the 1% patch. And if they see somebody, you know, riding with a 1% patch and they're not from one of the big clubs, they will go and rip it off of them or worse. They're very protective of who can be in the 1% club, if you will. And a lot of that patch structure, when you see a three-piece patch on somebody's back, then that's going to be one of the bigger five clubs or it could be one of the support clubs. But the support clubs won't have 1% on them. Some of them will have like 0.99%, which is kind of a joke, but the support clubs will have something. So like the Pagans had, it would be a P or a 16 and a support club would wear that patch. And so it showed that they were a support club of the Pagans. So they kind of flew under the protection of the Pagans.
There's a lot of symbolism and almost like numerology when it comes to these things. And I noticed that since Pagans are also white supremacists, they have that in common, right? Where it's like, this number means this, and this is the 14 words from Adolf Hitler, and this is the number of mother club members or branches of the club, and you got to put this in there, and then this skull has this in the shape of the eyes. They always do that, and it's a little culty, kind of.
I mean, it is. And you have some that are much stronger believers in it than others. Like, others are kind of like, yeah, I'm into that. And then others are like, hey, this is like the core of what we are. But you're right, there is a lot of similar. There was one, and I use the term old lady because that's how they refer to the females that are either they're married to girlfriends or whatever. It's not my view. But one of the old ladies had said, all these guys are, and she was drunk and probably shouldn't have said it, but she was like, hey, all these guys are is evil Boy Scouts. And that was a tribute back to the patches. Like all these patches that they wear, there's not a single patch they're wearing that doesn't mean something. Some of it may be trivial. And then, you know, with my colors, like I was selective of what patches I would put on. Because some of them you earn, some of them, it just depends on what's happening. Mm. But there were some that were given to me, you know, like the SS Lightning Bolts, some stuff like that. I wasn't like, oh no, hey, I'm not a believer in that. I just took them and never put them on my colors.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering how you got away with that. You know, like, how would you even explain that to some, like, oh, hey, this is an SS neck tat. Don't worry, daddy's going to cover it up with a butterfly when he's done with this project at work.
Well, after I become patched, so after 1 year in with the Pagans, you would get Sutar's sword on your neck. And it's kind of a level, like after 3 years, you can get the word Pagans or a small version of the colors. And then after 7 years, you can have full colors, like on your back, tattooed, that is. So the chapter president at the time was like, hey, listen, I got permission for you to get Sutar's sword early. They'd broken a bunch of things with me early. Like I became an officer earlier than I was supposed to, you know, not to jump ahead, but I got arrested. And so I should have been pushed out of the club until that case got adjudicated. We can get into that in a minute. But like, there's all these different things that they had, rules they broke it for me. So when it came to this, I'm like, hey, man, I go home with Sutar's sword in my neck. This is not going to play well with my wife to start with and then forget where else. And so I said to him, I said, hey, listen, man, I'm already getting some attitudes for some folks because, you know, I've been cutting corners and you guys have been doing things for me earlier than, you know, probably should have. Let's just let this one run out. Let me do my time and earn this one. The chapter president was like, hey, man, that's stand up 100% behind you. Yeah, let's do that. So it was another bullet dodged.
Yeah, no kidding. That's one of those kind of close calls. And it's funny, when I search for Sutar's sword, one thing that comes up is the Pagans Motorcycle Club worldwide trademark application for their insignia.
Yeah.
They have this trademark. Like there's an attorney of record on file. They have a registered agent office, everything. It shows the patch.
In the Mongols case, they seized the trademark for the Mongols. And it was a battle. It's gone on for years. I don't even know where it stands right now. Where the Mongols had it, could not use their colors. And then they got it reversed. And then they could use their colors. This ongoing battle that went on. But the Hells Angels, all that stuff's trademarked. Like they've all done it.
It makes sense when you think about it, but it's kind of funny. Like, we're outlaws, but make sure you register that trademark on time and don't let it lapse, right? It's like having a domain name in good standing or something for your meth and money laundering business.
And not for nothing. Like, you don't want to be making up your own Pagan shirt and wearing it around town because you will get called out and you will be beaten severely. I mean, if they found out somebody was wearing a Pagan shirt, like, you're not supposed to have, you could wear a shirt that says support 16s, and that's what they do for a lot of the supporters. They can wear those and they know what that means and people know what that, but you cannot have anything that says Pagan on it unless you are a Pagan.
Even if it's just like a random, the word Pagan, nothing to do with the club, they're still going to take offense or take issue with that, eh?
I mean, if you were on a baseball team and your last name's Pagan and you have Pagan on your back, like they're not going to come beat you out, you know, come out of the stands and beat you for it. But if you're in any reference to like what a Pagan would be, so if you had a t-shirt on that says, you know, Pagans are the best, you'd have problems.
Wow.
You'd have big problems.
Interesting.
And even as a prospect, you can't touch anything that says Pagans. You can't touch Pagan colors. Nobody's supposed to be touching. And there was an incident in the book that I talked to where somebody actually put their hand on the back of the chapter president and that created all sorts of problems.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's really interesting symbolism. And like, you see the same kind of reverence for the colors as you do for like a flag in North Korea, for example. Like, it really has cult languaging and everything. So you're building trust, you're staying at these guys' homes, you're drinking, you're hanging out with them. Another possibly foolish question, but why bother to go undercover and bust these guys? Are they mostly killing each other?
It's a great question because there is people out there that believe like, hey, bikers just kill bikers.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be further from the truth. And people have asked me, I'm like, how would you feel if a clubhouse opened up in your neighborhood? It's going to change your neighborhood dynamics dramatically, like to the point where you're not even going to be able to live there. They do extort. They sell drugs, like they affect, just like any other gang, they affect the area that they're in and they recruit from the areas that they're in. And they don't just, when I was in the club, they would extort protection money from whether it would be bars or different establishments, depending on what chapter and where you were. And so they're a criminal organization, just like anything else. The reason why to go undercover is you can, from the outside to, you know, maybe some prospects or some hangarounds, you'd be able to deal with, you know, maybe some low-level members. And maybe you can build a case on them. You're never getting anywhere near the leadership of the gang because they're insulated. The only way to do that is to go undercover in the club and go up into the ranks. For me, out of the 2 years, it probably took the first year and a half just to get to the level where I was dealing with other club members and the likes.
Wow. The way you describe these guys, they're all absolutely enormous. It's always like, this guy was 6'5", 345 pounds. Is that normal, or are these just the absolute monsters that you came across that were noteworthy? Like, is there anybody where you're like, yeah, he was 5'9 on a good day, depending on how thick the soles of his shoes were, former lawyer, now he's got a podcast, probably get his ass beat with two punches in a bar fight? Or is that not exactly the phenotype of what outlaw biker gangs are looking for?
I'll be honest, there were some little cats in there too.
Okay.
Some scrappy ones. But the chapter I was in had some very large humans.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not talking like weightlifters, fit marathon runners or anything like that. These were some big humans, had a lot of weight, but also for some of them were very tall. And so when we walked into the bars and into businesses, in some cases, like into restaurants, the presence, I mean, anybody wearing the collars is going to get, you know, some sort of recognition, but these are some large humans. And so people would stop and gasp and be very focused on, and quite honestly, feared them, you know, and you could see that when you walk into these areas.
Yeah.
Or they would be this sick attraction. Like, I could never say, like, we'd be in bars and you'd have guys who'd be coming up and like buying you beers and doing all this stuff like you were a sports star or a rock star. And then you'd have women, and some beautiful women, who'd be hitting on some of these guys. And some of these are the ugliest humans I've ever seen in my life. And they would regularly have, you know, some beautiful women who were very interested in being with them. And I could never figure out why.
Yeah, it's that whole bad boy thing turned up to 11. Seems like a little bit too dangerous, I think. It's not, I assume these women don't know what they're getting into a lot of the time.
You got to figure they have at least some idea. I mean, it's not like you're hiding it. They're wearing colors, they're in packs. You know, it's probably not a safe bet hanging out with this group of folks, but there was definitely that attraction. And I'm not saying everyone by any stretch of the imagination, but there were times, like, I'd be like, you got to be kidding me. How could she be interested in him? And some of it, I think, was just, like you said, the bad boy image.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, that's, yeah, it's bizarre. But also, I guess, look, power, if people are afraid of somebody and this person has that pattern in their past, I mean, that's a whole psychological episode of this podcast, I suppose. The pressure just seems enormous. You're no stranger to action and pressure. Tell me about that shootout you got involved in earlier in your career. That was kind of like, it seems like you got a taste right from the jump.
Yeah, it was supposed to be kind of a routine activity. And I was in between academies. And so at the time, I mean, they still have two different academies. You have a basic academy and then like the advanced, specialized, like geared towards your specific agency. And so at the time, you would go to the first one, which would be about 12 to 16 weeks. And then you'd have a gap of maybe 2-3 weeks. And then you go back down for another 12, 16 weeks. So in that gap, when I was back in LA, we were going and we were executing an arrest warrant. So it was going to be kind of like a buy bust for a couple kilos of coke. And then we were doing a search warrant on the apartment that was above where the buy bust was going to take place. And so the buy bust was going to be in a parking garage, LA style, you know, it's underneath and you can see into them, but they're gated and what have you. So I was on the team going in to secure the apartment and do the search warrant. But as we approached, it was right out of the get-go, the shots are fired. And so we had an agent go down who shot in the foot. One of the bad guys was standing. So the garage ends up closing. So those were inside, and those were outside. And you were not going to get through the other way. So it was.
So you're trapped in a parking structure that's locked with guys shooting at you and you shooting at them, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. So they had Tech Nines, they had some pretty good weaponry, but one of them was standing behind a pillar and there's rounds flying everywhere. There's hundreds of rounds that were fired and he never gets hit, which is amazing. The other one had multiple, it was like, I forget the exact count, but it was like 32 entry and 26 exit wounds. Like he had been shot, but the way he was shot and he was strung out on coke, he lived.
He lived? Unbelievable.
He was crushed behind our car. The only thing that stopped it was his magazine. He had an extended clip and the magazine got shot and all the rounds fell. And so that's really what ended at that. And an agent had come in, or an agent that was in there had a shotgun with a slug and it basically blew his arm off and that shut it down. And then we still had to go up and clear the apartment because we thought there was two more individuals up there. So we go to do that and then it gets locked down and it happened to be only about three blocks from where I lived, but it got locked down and we were there all night. It got a bunch of coverage. So then it's like you're trying to notify family members. And so anyways, long story short, they were like, hey, it's too stressful. We're not going to send you back to the academy. So I ended up being on the job for almost 2 years before I fully got through the academy. But one of the things they had done is because they had some undercover opportunities. And so they gave me a memo that said, hey, before you even go to the second academy, we're going to let you do some undercover work. And so I started doing undercover work before I even had finished doing the academy. And
wow.
But back in those days, LA was different in the sense that, you know, there were a whole lot of brand new agents. There were not a lot of senior agents. They were all trying to get out. It's too expensive, too dangerous. And so as a new agent, you got to do a lot of things that you weren't able to do in other areas in the country just because physically there was nobody else to do it. So you're given a lot of latitude. So it really helped you learn the job faster than, you know, somebody who might have been in, say, Boston.
Yeah, although being short-staffed and under-experienced is probably not a good, like, it's not exactly the best way to further your career, I suppose, or the safest way.
Yeah, plenty of ways that you could make mistakes or worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, I really valued my time in LA. I learned a lot by being out there.
This is the Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Ken Croak. We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored in part by Airbnb. You know, Jen and I love trotting around the globe. You gotta trot, you can't gallop or anything. And Airbnbs have become our go-to for a cozy stay wherever we land. So when we finally decided to put down roots and build our own place, we thought, why not sprinkle a bit of that Airbnb magic into our home? We went all out, designed it with a spare bedroom that comes with its own exterior door. This way, our guests can come and go as they please, making check-ins and check-outs a breeze. We've been lucky enough to host folks come into town to visit family and friends. Inspired by our travels, we wanted to make their stay extra special. So we began adding little personal touches here and there, snacks, bottled water, a brochure with our local recommendations that we made, even some cool samples from our show sponsors. It's all about making our guests feel welcomed and cherished. And really, when you think about it, why let your home just sit there gathering dust when it could be your ticket to more incredible adventures? Turning it into an Airbnb not only brings in a little extra cash, but it's also a fantastic way to share a piece of your world with others. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. It's a lot of work. Your support of our sponsors keeps us going here. To learn more and hear about the sponsors of the show and all those discount codes, everything, all those URLs, they're all in one place on one page. JordanHarbinger.com/deals is the page. You can also search for any of the sponsors using the search box on our website as well. Please consider supporting those who support this show. Now for the rest of part one with Ken Croak. Your parents must have been thrilled, right? You go to school, you get an accounting degree, and then you come out and you're getting shot at by drug dealers right like on the first year in or first few months in. It's like, what'd you do today? Oh man, this guy got shot 27 times.
I'll tell you, they were, you know, again, as you just said, I went to school for accounting. My dad was a CPA, my brother's a CPA. So they were like, oh, he'll be a CPA. And I was like, it's just not in my DNA to sit behind a desk for 25 years or whatever it is. And I applaud those who do, but it just wasn't for me. And my mom had, you know, a couple of big things. She hated motorcycles, hated tattoos, hated guns. And so I was, you know, pretty much like the giant disappointment, you know, because I had done them all. But and really, they were just concerned about my safety. I think they knew how much I liked the job and how much I put into doing the job. And they just wanted me to stay in one piece.
Sure. Yeah. No, understandable. You're doing all this exciting stuff. It's hard for them to be like, have you tried spreadsheets? Those are fun too.
They weren't digging when I was, particularly in this case, because I just looked like a dirtbag.
Yeah.
And so you're going to family events and even for my kids and stuff. It's hard to explain, you know, your shitbag, the son. Why does he look the way he does? But yeah, they got through it.
Yeah, this is my son, the deadbeat. Oh no, yeah. He's going to make something of himself. Like, oh man, they must be so disappointed in him. Yeah, oh man. It sounds a little bit like my career, except replace accounting degree with law degree and replace taking down international drug rings with doing a podcast in your underwear. So a lot of these guys, they seem mentally ill, the bikers. One of the least disgusting examples, aside from the violence, is the guy who found like freshly born kittens and licked the blood off of them. And he did so many worse things in the book, but I'm afraid if I describe him here, people will literally, if they're eating right now, they're gonna at least stop eating, if not worse. Because some of the examples are just like, I can't get them out of my head. They're so disgusting. And that's not even the crimes. This is just the weird personal habits of some of these dirtbags.
You know, it's funny. One of the folks that I knew who read the book, you know, their advice was don't read it while you're eating for that reason. And your stories tie back to Hogman. There's worse I chose not to put in there.
Yeah.
And so he, you know, he had a blood fetish. He was a vile human being. Even when you have, and to your point, you know, we don't have to cover them all here, but when you have a chapter president react in a very negative way and throw him out of the hospital that we were in when he had done something, it's like, you've crossed a line. You've really gone above and beyond if you can get a pagan to actually feel that that was disgusting. So yeah, he was at a different level. But you know, people always ask about like, what was the makeup? And the makeup was really just like society, just like any group of people. You know, you'd have some folks that were narcissists. You had some folks that were, you know, just looking for a belonging. You had other people just straight out criminals. You had other people who were just like, hey, I like this. I like to intimidate. I like to bully people. Maybe by themselves, they couldn't do it, but in a pack, they could. There was no really hidden formula. Like people were like, oh, there's a lot of military joining biker gangs. That's not what I saw. I mean, there were some military members, but no, not huge amount. I mean, there's a lot of different bike organizations out there. And going back to what we were talking about, the 1%, the vast majority of them are just in bike clubs. And listen, law enforcement has bike clubs. You know, much to my chagrin, when I do presentations, you know, I ask, anybody in here part of law enforcement, any part of a club? And if you have a structure in there, like a sergeant arms and a president of those things, and I'm like, you know what, you're in the wrong profession, because why do you need a sergeant arms? What does a sergeant arms do? But there's like really no rhyme or reason of who belongs to it and who's successful at it.
You've got to really work to create this sort of undercover life and character, right? Because I assume you need to have like a fake high school diploma or bills laying around or fake junk mail that's addressed to your fake name. There's got to be an office that helps with that, I assume, at ATF, right?
Yeah. And there's one of those things that you do over the course of your career. You have one or maybe more undercover identities that you're building over time. Like they do an extensive background. I had to fill out a bunch of forms, a very long background. They were supposed to polygraph, which they ultimately ended up not doing, but they have, and other clubs do. So you have to have all these things lined up. And then, you know, so my criminal history, you know, so I was a convicted felon in my undercover world. You know, my felony was for kicking the shit out of a cop, which was not a good choice that I later lived to regret. But all of a sudden I get arrested, and now all that comes into play. So you have all these different levels of backstopping, if you will. And you never know if it's going to come into play, but you better have it squared away, because when something happens, so like when I got arrested, they're going to pull those prior convictions, and there better be prior convictions. There better be police reports when they order them and all those kind of things, or that's the end of it. Because the attorney that was representing me was a pagan attorney given to me by the pagans. So you don't think they're going to make a quick call and say, hey, by the way, this guy, you know, I know you told you he's a convicted felon. There's no felony conviction. He never was convicted. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, that name doesn't even exist. So there is a lot that goes into it, and a lot that I don't spend a lot of time talking about because I don't want to give up something. But just simple things, like it's just more common sense. But like you get all this junk mail at your house. Well, you get it because you belong to all sorts of different things. You do different things. But when you don't do anything because you don't exist, you don't get junk mail. So like how right. do you get junk mail? So you actually have to put in an effort to go out and get yourself on these mailing lists that you wish you could get your real life off of. But you have to do that so you can have this stuff. Because when they come to your house in your apartment, you better have that stuff there. It can't be this sterile environment.
Yeah, you need like a birthday card from a used car dealership that's like, come in and look for your new ride. Yeah, that annoying ass crap car warranty spam.
Yeah, and you better have a story about like, what's your family? Who are your family? Where are they? Because they did, you know, background checks, and they went and did surveillance on where I said I work. They did a lot of their homework on me. And so if you say, hey, your dad lives at 123 Main Street, they're going to go by to see if your dad's there. Now, they may not knock on the door. They may just sit there and watch to see if he comes out. Who knows what they're going to do? But you better have your stuff squared away.
What's really cringe, that I remember reading in the book, that this is really cringe. Y'all kiss each other on the lips as a greeting. Like, what the heck is that about? That's so gross.
It is a accepted biker. You know, they all do it. Most will kiss on the lips. Some will kiss on the cheek. It's kind of hard to explain, but it is what it is. But there's some that, like Hogman, dude had a blood fetish. Like, who wants to be kissing that guy?
Yeah, that's why it's gross. I don't care about the dudes kissing each other on the lips. That's the least gross part. The part that's gross is these guys probably have hepatitis for the last 20 years from sharing needles and stuff.
And a lot of them did. And openly would tell you, I have hepatitis. And they'd be like, hey, by the way, you want to try my pasta? It's like, no, I'm pretty sure I'm all set, man. Thanks.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I had a wonderful personal doctor who every opportunity was testing me for everything under the sun because you just never knew. You know, what you were being exposed to.
Yeah, I have to clarify that. I don't want people to think that it's a homophobic thing. That's far from it. It's mostly that these guys are, the guy you talked about before who licked the blood off the kittens. When you read the book, you'll understand why you wouldn't want to kiss a guy like that on the lips besides the kitten thing. That was like the G-rated version compared to the stuff that was in the book. And you said there was stuff that didn't even make it. And yeah, he's not the only gross one in the pack. That's for damn sure.
And they would joke amongst themselves.
Yeah.
You know, there was one guy named Wiz. Dude had lizard breath, and it was like nobody wanted to, you know, every time he's come, they're like, oh God, here comes Wiz. Like, so they would joke amongst themselves about who is still part of the culture. You had to do it, but nobody enjoyed it, you know?
God. How do undercovers get permission to do illegal things? I had a guy on the show named Joe Barone. He was a mafia gangster turned FBI informant. He showed me a lot of his court documents and the FBI clearing him for doing illegal activity, but it was pretty vague. You know, it was like, maybe involved in money laundering and other racketeering gambling activities. And I was like, man, that's a wide berth of illegal stuff.
But there's no way to script it, right? You don't know, you know, like I was saying earlier, like I didn't know how my day was going to turn on any day, and you don't know what criminal activity. Now, there was never going to be a day that I was going to go out and be part of a murder or anything like that. You're not authorized to do it, nor would I do it even if I was. But, you know, when it came to narcotics trafficking or weapons trafficking, then yeah, those things could happen and did happen, and that you had to have the authorization. So your agency, along with the U.S. Attorney's Office, they basically signed a memorandum saying that you're authorized to participate in these, you know, tier one, tier two activities, blah, blah, blah. And it's all part of when you're starting the case up and you get those things in order ahead of time.
You did all this when you had kids. Your wife must have just loved that. That's so stressful already. But when you have kids and you're married, it's just 10x.
Yeah. Like I could tell you, people are always like, oh, I can't believe your marriage survived. And I'm like, well, listen, the first thing I'll tell you, if you're ever looking for like how to strengthen your marriage, going undercover for 2 years is not going to be on that list of things to do. But, you know, my wife was an agent. And so that's great. She understood what it was, but it was also horrible because she understood what it was.
Right. You can't lie to her and be like, no, no, no. I'm safe the whole time. They're right next to me. I'm wearing a wire. She's like, that's bullshit. And I know it.
She could go in and pull up the report. She had access to the system.
That's
she could
even
see
worse.
Every single thing.
That's
so yeah, there's absolutely no BS in her as to what it was. But yeah, and then she had the burden, you know, our girls were teenagers at the time. You know, that's just a tough age to start with. And so she's dealing with that. She had her own job, and then she's got, you know, she's getting phone calls in the middle of the night that Ken got arrested or whatever was happening in that time, because the case agent would try to keep her as up to date as he could to what my activities were. So it was a very tough time, really, for the whole family. And a lot of stuff with the kids was kept from me at the time because my wife wanted me to focus on what I was doing. And you learn a lot about it after or later. And even to this day, they now know, they have a really good view of the case, but they didn't know a lot of what had happened. And then, you know, they read the book, and they're a big part of why I wrote the book. I had no intention of writing a book. My wife and my daughters were like, you need to memorialize this because you'll be gone someday. And the story needs to be told. And so that's what, you know, made me do it.
Yeah, I loved it. I plowed through the book in 2 days. I mean, I'm a fast reader, but 2 days is, that's fast for a book of this size.
That's good. That means it had to, I wanted it to be an easy read. I wanted it to be, you know, ability for somebody to come in and take a look inside my world during that time to just get really kind of get a feel for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So your wife was an undercover as well. What type of work was she doing?
So it goes back to your original question about, hey, do you have to do undercover? And so my wife, Hispanic female, and so she was kind of like, hey, we need you to do this. And so she was working in New York. And so they would ask her to go in and buy drugs, more drugs, sometimes guns, in the projects in New York. And, you know, first of all, there's no cover team. Some of those projects go up 30, 40 floors. There's no cover team ever going to get to you. And being a female, that brings up a whole lot of other concerns and risks. She was very good at it, but she didn't like it. And when we were early dating, and I was in California, and I had the better end of the deal only because we'd both be doing undercover at the same time or in the same day. And so for her, she'd be, you know, doing a drug buy at 11 o'clock at night. Well, that's 8 o'clock for me. We would notify each other when we were safe. But for me, if I'm doing it at midnight, it's 3 o'clock in the morning for her. So she lost a lot of sleep over that time because, you know, she wouldn't, you know, hear from me. And I was involved in the shooting in one of the undercover deals that I had done, and she didn't hear from me for like a day. So there was a lot of stress that went with that, but she was really good at it. But when we got married and she came out to LA, she's like, you know, I really just don't like this. I don't like doing it. I'm like, then don't do it. And I said, here's a clean break. You come in a new division. Just so that the ASAC at the time, who's a really good guy, said, oh, I can't wait to get you going undercover. I heard all the stuff you did in New York.
That's the special agent in charge, right? So he's like the boss.
So the assistant special agent in charge. So he's like, there's two of those below the special agent in charge.
Oh, you said ASAC. Okay.
And he was like, hey, can't wait to get you involved in undercover work out here. You'll be a great fit. And so she told him, she's like, yeah, I'm not doing undercover work anymore. And he was like, what? What are you talking about? I was like, hey, this is a perfect opportunity. So she focused her career more on arson explosives.
Arson and explosives. Wow.
Yeah, that was her thing. And more of a whodunit, like something blows up and you figure out who did it, where mine was more like, okay, here's the people who are doing it, build the box around them type of thing.
All right, part two coming up in a few days. Links to all things Ken Croak will be on the website in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com. Please use our website links. If you do buy the book, it does help support the show. Transcripts are in the show notes, videos up on YouTube, advertisers, deals, and discount codes, all at jordanharbinger.com/deals. Please consider supporting those who support this show. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn. I always love talking with you there. I'm teaching you how to connect with great people and manage relationships using the same software, systems, and tiny habits that I use every day. Most of the guests you hear on the show are subscribing or contributing to the course or both. So come join us. You'll be in great company. JordanHarbinger.com/course is where you can find it. You got to build those relationships, folks. Dig the well before you get thirsty. This show is created in association with Podcast One. My team is Jen Harbinger, Jace Sanderson, Robert Fogarty, Millie Ocampo, Ian Baird, Josh Ballard, and Gabriel Mizrahi. Remember, we rise by lifting others. The fee for this show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful or interesting. If you know somebody who's into these undercover true crime or biker gang stuff, cop stuff, share this episode with them. It's a great episode to get people started with our show. The greatest compliment you can give us is to share the show with those you care about. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.